When I got my PhD in 1952, I went to the National Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. This was because one of the fellows that worked in the lab, he worked there for a few months, maybe 6 months or something like that. He was with the Bureau of Standards, had been there on sort of a sabbatical, and he convinced me that that was a good place to go and a place I would enjoy. His name was Judd French. He's now director of the National Bureau of Standards, and he's been a director for laboratory director there for a number of years. Anyway, I went to work there in what they call the old tube lab, which was a facility that was built during the Second World War to build fuses for bombs, rockets, and mortars. And this was the project that I worked on. My thesis at MIT involved gas discharge, microwave gas discharges. And so I worked on gas trigger tubes at National Bureau of Standards. We had a mortar fuse that was a proximity fuse, and when it approached the earth, it was had a split shell. And because it was split, that is insulated, the front part of the shell was insulated from the rear part, and across that was this gas trigger tube. And as the shell would approach the earth, it would pick up the static charge, discharge the tube, which would then blow the shell up before it hit the ground. And so my job dealt with this gas trigger tube. Well, that didn't last too long, perhaps a year or so, and the function of that part of National Bureau of Standards was split off and became the Diamond Ordnance Fuse Laboratories, or DOFL. And it was part of the National Department of the Army, Department of Defense. And the people, the supervisors there, recognized that they needed to miniaturize their electronics. At that point, they were using miniaturized, not necessarily for gas tubes, but for other types of fusing, and bombs and so on. They used vacuum tubes. These were too big, and they drew too much power and so on. And so they were looking at transistors. Well, very difficult to buy transistors, and so they decided they would make transistors. So I was in charge of building up the facility to make the transistors. And we started with germanium and refined the germanium, drew the crystals, sliced the crystals, diffused the junctions, did the whole thing, packaged them, and just made them from scratch. A wonderful opportunity. Of course, you couldn't buy equipment, so we built our own equipment, and just wonderful opportunity to learn semiconductors, which I had not had the opportunity to learn in college and at MIT because it wasn't taught at that time. Now, let me back up a minute and talk about go back to MIT for just a minute. One of the classmates that I had there at MIT was a fellow by the name of Bob Noyce. And he and I were not exactly buddy-buddy, but we were in the same classes, and we spoke to each other and went to the same professor parties and this sort of thing. So we were friendly. And of course, he later became one of the co-inventors of the integrated circuit, so I was very familiar with him. Okay, back to National Bureau of Standards. The approach that we used, that we came up with at the National Bureau of Standards to miniaturize circuits, was called 2D, meaning two-dimensional. And so we would come up with a little thing of that size of postage stamp, and on that we would screen silk screen resistors and conductors and capacitors, and then we would insert unencapsulated transistors in this that we had made and integrate them using evaporated leads onto the chip. And I have some pictures of that sort of thing here. So maybe we could just look at this for a minute, and I'll show you the documentation. The first time we presented what we had on this was Friday, November 1st, 1957, at the Electron Devices meeting in Washington at a late newspaper. And this described the approach that we had. And I have a paper here that you can look at. And this was picked up very quickly by the press. And you see things like an electronic news on the 25th of November, 57. Transistors in printed scene miniaturization step. Then we were in the Washington Post at that point with our pictures. And this shows a little circuit that was reduced in size, this postage stamp thing. So the whole approach that we were involved with was miniaturizing circuits. And the reason we wanted to miniaturize them was so we could put them inside of bombs, rockets, and mortars and do this fusing. And we have a number of articles here. Here's one, none of the transistors made by photography. The idea was that you could print transistors. Well, that's not a true statement at that point, but that's what caught the popular press. And so we were very widely played up on it. We made a little display at that point, which is a shift register countdown from an oscillator. And the idea, it was battery powered and in a Lucite box. And the oscillator would oscillate and then count down until the output was a little LED. It wasn't an LED at that point. It was just an incandescent lamp, and it would blink. And so it would count down to the point where it would go blink, 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 like that. And then we would put our little postage stamp flip-flop in there with switches so that you could switch it in or out. And if you switched it in, then instead of going blink, 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 it would go blink, blink, blink. In other words, a divide by two flip-flop. And so this is quite a nice demonstration, because you could put this on a table and you could explain what we had done, how we miniaturized this circuit down to just a postage stamp, and look, we can demonstrate it, and people could say, gee whiz, that's fantastic. And so Jim Knoll, who was my co-worker, and I presented a paper on that at the World's Fair in Brussels in 1958. And there in attendance was Shockley, and he was very impressed with it. In fact, he invited Jim Knoll and myself to become members of his team at that point. And we decided we didn't particularly want to work for Shockley for one reason or another, and so we declined, but it was nice of him to ask anyway. Well, we showed this around Europe, and we showed it at Siemens in Germany and places of that sort. And everybody admired it, but said, and showed it to Dummer in England, and at RRE. And maybe it's RRL, I forget which.
It's RRL.
RRL, okay. Yeah. Royal Radar Laboratory or something like that. Yeah. And so we showed it to these people, and most of the people said, gee, that's fantastic, but in our country, we're not interested in that because we don't have big defense problems and so on, and we'll let you Americans worry about miniaturizing. Nobody at that point foresaw the commercial applications of this. It all seemed like a very expensive toy for military applications. That occurred in 1958, and in the fall of in the summer of 1958, I left Diamond Orange and Shoes Laboratories to work for industry. I went to Texas Instruments in Dallas, and when I went there, I met Jack Kilby. And Jack had arrived shortly before I did. He went in May, I believe. And he'd started work, and this same person that hired Jack hired me, Willis Adcock. And the TI didn't know exactly what they wanted to do in terms of miniaturization, but they knew they wanted to do something because there was a pretty large market out there if they could figure out how to do it. And so they gave Jack the problem of figuring this out, trying to do something, and he made a few stabs at it. And at that time, as you probably know, David, TI shut down during summer vacation for 2 weeks. But if you hadn't been a full-time employee for a year, you didn't get any vacation. So Jack was left there for 2 weeks with no guidance and nobody else in the plant, basically. And so all Willis had told him to do was see what he could come up with. And he thought about it a while and decided, well, if he could make the components out of the same thing the transistors were made out of that TI had used so effectively up to this point, then he could make the make it all out of a single chip. And so he breadboarded up various simple circuits. He would take a chip of silicon and a transistor, and he'd interconnect these with wires and so on. And lo and behold, the thing worked. And so the next thing was to make it in one piece, which he did, and demonstrated this, I think, on about the 12th of September in 1958. And I happened to be, at that point, working on some oxide removal techniques for transistors to just up the few doors away from his place, and Willis called me down to see this thing, and I looked at it, and I was amazed, like everybody else. And so that was my first view of an integrated circuit. Mm-hmm. But, of course, let me back up again. While at the Diamond Orange Fuse Laboratories, one of the trips we made in the 50s, I would guess probably 55 or so on, was to Philco in Philadelphia to look at their surface barrier transistors. And the fellow in charge there was Bob Neutz. And so he and I greeted each other, long-lost school buddies, and he showed us around the plant, and we were amazed at that. But I just thought I'd throw that in because this is, to me, it's been quite an accomplishment to know both of these fellows, both Jack Kilby and Bob Neutz. And to have worked with one and gone to school with the other and so on. And but Jack's problem with the integrated circuit was that he used air isolation primarily. That is, and by the way, shortly after he demonstrated this on 12th September, I was assigned to him and worked with him for the next 10 years while I was there. And the first job was to figure out how to cut intricate shapes out of silicon to use this air isolation. Doing this then required the bonds to be made with wires. And so Jack's integrated circuit was basically a single piece of silicon, all right, but it had wires, jumper wires here and there throughout for the interconnection. Jack worked on a patent all that fall, and in the spring, I guess January, February, when he filed it, he realized that he couldn't always count, or it didn't make sense on using jumper wires and air isolation all the time. So he threw in the point about the interconnections could be evaporated, or vacuum deposited interconnections of metals such as gold. Now, that one word was the problem that he ran into on the patent, because if he had said such as aluminum, he would have been given single credit, I believe, before the integrated circuit. As it was, Bob Noyce got wind somehow what Jack had done, and had gone to the planar structure using oxide insulation, native oxide, deposited aluminum on there. Aluminum sticks to oxide, gold doesn't stick to oxide. And later on, when T.I. and Fairchild were in great conflict over this patent situation, I was given the job, my group, of trying to get gold to stick to oxide in the hopes of invalidating the Fairchild claim. And we never could do it. There's no way that you can get gold to stick. Maybe you can do it today, I don't know, but in those days with the techniques that we had, we could never get gold to adhere to oxide satisfactory, whereas aluminum does beautifully. So it's a shame that Jack never, that he used those words. And furthermore, that he played it so close to the vest that no one else got to see the patent before it went in, who could warn him that gold was not the thing to put down on oxide if he's going to use oxide. So that's sort of an interesting aspect of the integrated circuit. Well, in the next 10 years, we worked hard on making integrated circuits. One of the most difficult things in the early days was convincing anyone that they were any good for anything. I can remember I would go out and make conference talk after conference talk and be on panel discussions and so on, trying to defend the integrated circuit against all comers. And most people felt that they would be too expensive and they were unreliable because nobody could make them very well and this sort of thing. And of course, all these things are just exactly wrong. They're an inexpensive way to make electronic circuits, the most reliable way, and so on. The whole program, of course, was driven in the early days by miniaturization, and later on it became driven by commercial application, not just miniaturization. Miniaturization by itself was sort of inconsequential.